Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about review of genetics and DNA. In this podcast, I'm going to challenge myself to discuss a few of the wiry concepts out here. So I suppose we'll start off with the DNA test that proved that the mother of the child was indeed not the mother of the child. And this is just a start off, and then we'll get into some more details. This is one of the things where propaganda and reporting tends to actually lead understanding with things that are reported, and so you understand the report, but from the report the actual science is a little bit far off it. Now obviously one of the fundamental uses of DNA is to identify an individual in a crime scene or whatever, and also to determine whose mother and father it is. And so obviously it's a little bit more iffy to determine a father. So if you find that the father is not the natural father, so you do a DNA test on the son or daughter, and they have genetic information which doesn't match the genetic information of the father, you can say, oh, well, look, I understand what the sequence is then. So let's just go around and see what happens. So we'll stop a little bit. So you have egg and sperm factories in the mother and father, respectively. And those egg and sperm factories take a copy of the grandmother and grandfather DNA on top of each other and lined it up, and it splices and crosses over. So say if I have a sequence of 1 to 100 in the length of DNA, or 1 to 5 maybe the mum, then initially it starts off two DNAs, 1 to 100, one on top is the father, one underneath is the mother. In a splicing situation, you can cut the actual DNA and splice over. So in this case, 1 to 5 is the mother, 5 to 55 is the father, 55 to 63 is the mother again, then 64 up to 100 is the father. So you can splice and move over. Now, I've described one piece of DNA. The complementary parts of DNA, you subtract, you rotate mother to father. So you mix up your grandmother and grandfather. It's provided by your one by your mother and one by your father, put across. And so you are carrying a copy of your mother's and father's DNA. So they will have segments of their DNA, and so you can read this DNA of a person and determine who's your mother and who's your father. And it's not straightforward. The DNA is not an exact match. Your father contains both your grandmother's and grandfather's DNA, and you'll have sections of your DNA from your grandmother and grandfather floating around in you. And so you can determine fairly conclusively that your father had a particular mother and father, and that you have a particular grandmother and grandfather. So if the person shares a mother and father who's your grandmother and grandfather, that determines the paternity. And so this is often used, there's suspicion and doubts, and in order to get some money or compensation or payment, or accusation of culpability or whatever it is. This is in prenuptial agreements. In various countries, you can do a DNA test for paternity. But what has been found out is the mother. So how can a mother give birth to a child without the actual DNA coming across? And there is this process where called chimerism. That's where the mother can be a broken up into distinct sections. Now, in certain senses, all females are chimeras. That is, they have different, multiple chimeras. Just incredibly complex because they have identical X and Y. X and X chromosome. So they can have sections of it which are predominantly from their mother, and sections, some cells, which are predominantly from their father, depends, because you've got a double copy of the X chromosome to determine which one operates. So in general, let's talk about it, your chromosomes. So I think it's karyotype. The words escape me. This is why I'm talking about this. So if we're diploid, so we've got a copy of the mother and a copy of the father. Other people, it's much more complex than that. Humans and mammals, it's fairly simple. You've got one and the other. And that means you've essentially got a backup. So if one gene isn't working on one, you've got the backup copy. And if one gene is working well, it will actually, in one copy, it may switch off the gene in the other copy. You've got recessive and dominant traits due to this diploid thing happening. Now, there's various mechanisms where you can have a complete chimera. I think it's chimera, I can't pronounce it properly. That's where you are actually made out of a combination of two different individuals. Now, one thing I've heard, and I haven't written, I don't know exactly how it is, in that there is a point in which the embryo goes along and it's about to fuse into two separate non-identical twins. And so it's about to go ahead. And the twins, so there's two separate eggs, and that embryo fuses. Now, I don't know quite how this can possibly happen mechanically. That's what's been told to me. That's how you get chimera. And there's another genetic way. Essentially, you have to both sections of the body has the same grandmother, but it will have different mixes of the fathers. The father's going up, or I don't know, it could be more complete. You can have completely, you could be a non-identical twin which is fused by some method, which means that although your hair sample, body sample, and everything else like that will be of one, you may actually be carrying the uterus of a different individual, uterus and reproductive position of a different individual. So this is a complex thing. Now the I search on the internet. Unfortunately, this is what I'm doing at the moment, is just exercising my brain. There's a famous paternity case where this mother said I wanted to check whether the child was the paternity. And it was found correct that the child had the father, but the mother was not the actual mother, even though they had witnesses. And when the mother was going to give birth for a third time, the sheriff, this is in the US, came in and said, "We need a witness." And they did the test, and they found that she gave birth. They physically viewed her give birth to a child who's not the who's not genetically directly related to her. And the way that they did this is that they took a sample from the cervix and genetic regions and found that the mother was a chimera. And there's a famous internet person, Lydia. If I really thought about it, I'd be able to think of her name. She's another famous case where the DNA tests proved the mother was not the actual mother, even though you had physical evidence that the child was carried. And so you can have this in surrogacy, but in these cases there's no surrogacy program going on. So surrogacy is where you've got a woman and you implant a fertilized egg inside her. So this is what it looked like to go and try and explain it. What we'll have here is a brief chat about general information on DNA. It's not intended to be an exploratory whiz-bang podcast, it's just to describe it. So DNA itself contains the information to make up an organism, and from looking at the DNA we can check what the parents are or not, and there's some mysteries associated with it. And so essentially DNA is the bit which conveys the information to make up an organism. Now, an organism is made up of cell bits. So the cell bits are made up of basic machines made up of RNA. So RNA is ribonucleic acid. And so ribose is a sugar. And some machines can be made directly of it. So the DNA makes RNA. And so the RNA, some of it can be made directly into machines. So there are direct machines from RNA. So you can just get a piece of RNA and it will fold up. It's a rather clumsy machine, big machine. But those machines, those very clumsy machines, have the ability to, some of those clumsy machines have the ability to make other, much more variable machines called proteins. So the DNA codes for RNA. Some of the RNA has got a function. Then that some of the RNA goes off and makes protein. So the protein is made with some of the following machinery parts. So there's three RNA machinery parts which go together to make a protein. So a protein is produced by these RNA machines. And we'll talk about the DNA a little bit later on. So the RNA machine requires three components. One is the rRNA, the ribose nucleic acid machine. It requires the tRNA, which is a little machine which all it does is it goes around, picks up a amino acid, a specific amino acid, and then it goes into this rRNA and it sequences on and hooks on the next piece of the protein. And of course there's another piece of RNA which actually conveys the information from the DNA. So these two go to make proteins. Proteins go off to other bits which actually fold them into machines, and some of the machines themselves are chemical machines and mechanical machines and chemical machines. The chemical machines go off and make chemicals like fats and acid, and eventually this hierarchy from the DNA through the RNA produces machines of RNA machines and protein machines, and the protein machines go off and produce other components like chemicals, messenger chemicals and stuff like that. So this is this whole chemistry. The DNA provides the blueprint to make machines, to make chemicals that make even more chemicals. So the main thing that the DNA can only produce, it can only code for, the only thing it does produce at the end is proteins. It can produce some RNA machines, some protein machines. And these protein machines are little nanomachines inside your cells which produce things. So that's the hierarchy of things. Now the DNA is a little bit more complicated than that. In that, it has a start, and it's got exons in on, so it will have a section of DNA which will eventually be coded for a individual protein, and that's called a gene. So a gene is a segment of DNA which then produces a protein. Now, what happens is there's a switch, a chemical switch, which switches on the production of protein. So it's not just, if you can imagine, the DNA is not just plugged on and all things going on. It's like plugging on your TV, and it switches on the volume, the CD player, the lights, some other aspects. It doesn't switch on all this first. It switches it on. It's in standby mode, and it's looking for other chemicals which go over and interact and switch on the genes. So your genes will be switched on. So, and a good example of that is when a Westerner in particular drinks some milk, they have a gene which detects the lactose acid, the lactose sugar, and it sends out a molecule called lactase, which then breaks that sugar up, allows it to be digested, so it turns it into a nice sweet sugar, rather than eventually turn into a toxin. This switch is normally on babies, and it's switched off after a particular while. Normally, adults don't drink milk. Now, you can well imagine this would be a major thing, because it's sort of almost like if you did have an adult which drank milk, they would actually probably milk themselves, or there'd be a structure which wouldn't be as positive. Basically, we didn't evolve to milk ourselves. We've evolved to milk cattle, so we can actually keep this lactose process going on. The important point here is that there's your DNA, which has got a section for your gene to produce a proton, but there's things in the front, switches on the front of it, complicated switches, which enzymes go in and lock in and start to produce chemicals. So your DNA is a programmable piece of program code, and it responds to its chemical environment and stuff like that. So it's basically got intelligence. It sort of senses, but it sort of senses with chemicals. So one chemical comes in, another chemical goes out. So it's actually actively, your DNA is sensing its chemical environment and sending out DNA function. It's incredible that it all works. And so we're going to talk a bit about what the DNA is in a short while. But your genes in bacteria, and I'm not quite sure. I think I've memorized that it comes in pairs. It may not come in pairs. That's just in my memory. But the gene is incomplete. Is a complete sequence. It's from A to B, or say from 1 to 1,000, if it's 1,000 base pairs long, it will produce a molecule, 1,000 long, and you've got a piece of DNA, and it just reads off that DNA, and that DNA is converted to RNA, which then goes off and produces the protein. Now, remember that the DNA in bacteria, particularly, is in little springy loops. So one of the important things is that DNA repels each other. So DNA is, if you've got a huge, so inside you is roughly 2 meters of DNA cut up into 46 segments, and you could get that and lay it on the floor, and you'd find inside you is duploid. You'd find you've got 2 genes 16, 2 genes 13. They're numbered at certain lengths, and you can put them side by side. And I think when you put it side by side in a particular way of imaging, that people like a mugshot, police mugshot of it all, you can see that's there. Now, the reason that you put it together side by side is that you can see that you should have a duploid. Now, occasionally people get an extra copy of one, or the copies won't be the same size, or whatever it is. This putting it aside is a sort of a really crude way of computing what's going on. And of course, females will have for the 23rd genome 2 identical X. Males will have a bit more. They won't have an identical X. They'll have a single X and a single Y, which is basically cut down X chromosome. And so there's a little bit less information in males. Well, a little bit less and a little bit more. There's a little bit more information in males because they've got an extra chromosome. They have actually 22 repeats and two exclusive sex chromosomes, where females have 23 repeats. So females, everything is repeated and backed up, and so they're more reliable. Males have a little bit extra going in, and that little bit extra, unfortunately, doesn't add very much. It just adds sort of a bit of things. Does basically male, makes people male. So your default is female, and if you surrender your female backup, you can have a male implant them. So going back to your bacteria, your bacteria is in little rings where the DNA is stored. And each section of DNA in your will have a complete sequence. But in you, you're a bit more complicated. Your DNA will not be readable, but you can highlight sections of that text. So the text was, the cat sat on the mat, the swift brown fox jumped over the lazy dog, etc., blah, 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 and it writes along. And what you can do is you highlight little sections of that, the highlighter, and then ignore the rest. That's exons and introns. So when it comes out, the cell is smart enough to get the take a print and then cut it up such as a functioning piece of DNA. Why it goes like that is hard to know. And this is where we come up against perhaps our first thing, that we are eukaryotes, which is the slave master cells. So there's ancient cells, archaic cells, there's bacteria cells with a hard wall with the little circular bits of DNA in it. So archaic cells have bits of strands of DNA. I think bacteria have got the loops of DNA. Archaic cells, archaea cells, are what we now call extremophiles. So originally, the Earth was completely extreme. There was no beautiful meadows, and we have created, for what the extremophiles feel, that the entire Earth has got an extreme amount of oxygen. Now, we think this is normal, but far as these cells, extremophiles cells, they can die off everywhere except where there's no oxygen. So it's can be anaerobic bacteria, but it's sort of bugs which get into your stomach. Now, it's interesting that, brace yourself for it, only these archaic cells and a few bacteria, a few very simple life forms have we got the complete genome for. So you say, what? It means that we've worked out how to map a genome, and we'll get into that in a short little bit, but we have made a claim that we have mapped the entire genome. I would believe that, but when you read into it, there are still mystery areas that they haven't quite tracked down yet. They've said, yep, it's all okay. I think they've tracked down all the genes in your genome. So your gene may be less than 1 or 2% of your genome. So in 1 to 100, say if I've got 1 to 1,000, on average you might have, say, 10 genes if you're lucky in that section, and say at 63, 114, 250, and so forth, that would be interspaced in there, so the rest is okay. Now, the thing is that we've got simple cells where the genes are all in one spot, and there's genetic information is all in one locus, like archaic cells or bacteria. We've got its full genomes, but we humans have multicellular organisms, you can possibly say that, but also our cells are multi-component cells. So we have the nucleus, which has got the bulk of our DNA, but we also have mitochondria, and yet I believe other structures which contain tiny amounts of DNA. So what happens is that when a cell reproduces, everything else is, besides the mitochondria, is made a copy of. The mitochondria has to reproduce itself. Mitochondria goes through asexual reproduction within our cell. Okay, that's a bit hard to go. It's just as well, because in some cases, the mitochondria is, some cells are decided that. So having a mitochondria is like having a pet puppy in your cell. So if you get one pet puppy, you have to buy so much dog food and a dog license for it and to keep it. However, what you can do is that you can say, my little apartment block is going to have 5,000 puppies in it. And it's great. You can really bark when I say there are some cells with 5,000 mitochondria. So inside you is your nucleus, but there's also ancient bacteria called mitochondria. And these little hardware wall doodads have the thing of eating up sugar, breathing in oxygen and out carbon dioxide, and producing cell fuel, adenosine triphosphate. This is cell food, and essentially this cell fuel is these chemicals which are structured in which the electrons are pulled apart. It's a molecule with a electron repelling side, an electron absorbing side, and they're little batteries. These little AA cell batteries, they're triple phosphate batteries. They go along, they've got a charge and a dipole transition, so they go around and they can go into an nanomachine and electrically power it, giving a little pulse of electricity to these nanomachines, which are your nanobots inside of it. So, what we have found is that the human genome is incredibly complex. There's not just 46, 23, and 23. That's backed up or not quite backed up. There's 22 backups, and depending on whether you're man or woman, there's yet another backup for sex cells or a differentiation. But beyond that, there are other bits of mitochondrial DNA floating about. And apparently it's a big, hairy beast, and indeed we have not sequenced any mammal so far. We have not got the whole sequence of any mammals. There's a lot of very small life forms. We can find out a lot of very interesting information from the DNA. We can actually identify who's who and see genetic information, but we haven't actually finally completed the round out there and actually detect the full length of DNA. And that will come eventually, I would expect. But we've gone through a sequence of them. So the DNA has the function that it peels open and exposes its teeth, its littered teeth, A, C, T, G. You've got the four different types of bases. Exposes them and RNA template is made. And the RNA template, the important thing about RNA and DNA, they're different. DNA is RNA which has been deoxied. So it's not deoxy, 2-di, it's D. It is, the oxygen has been taken away from the sugars. Now, your sugars are very highly water-soluble, but if you remove the hydroxide for them, you make them a bit oily. So your DNA has got this weird structure. It's very water-attractant on the very inside, oily on the outside, so water, and then it's water repellent on the outside. So what happens is that your DNA is this molecule, and it's oily and sticks to sever because the water outside repels it, but it's zipped on the inside by these hydrogen bonds, which are different from electron bonds. It is a chemical bond in the inside, but it's a bond not as we understand in most of chemistry. It's the thing binding the two bits of DNA together, and not electrons. It's hydrogens. The hydrogens are dropping from side to side. So you've got oil repulsive parts, and it means that the DNA basically doesn't like being coiled in front of it. It's like this magic silly rope that you hold in the bag, and it will fill up against the bag and push against the outside. And if you open it up, if you cut open the bag, it will spurt out like this funny magician's stuff. And you can pull it up, and it takes a bit of energy to put it together. And it's slightly oily and water repellent. So the DNA is put in this nuclear bag, and there's a pressure on it. The DNA would like to move apart, and its repulsion means that when the DNA separates, So when the DNA is operating inside your cell, it's not all wound up as you see it. It's all unwound. But it remains in certain segments. And the reason why it doesn't mix is that it's under pressure. So I don't know if you can imagine you have I suppose the best way to think of it is a sleeping bag. You put in a sleeping bag. Instead of a sleeping bag, you put in socks. Now, if you put in just a few socks, just one or two socks, what will happen is that as you walk around, those socks will miss and change places, and if there were stringy socks, they would intertwine. However, if the socks are repelled from each other, they're sort of held in position because they're pressurized away from each other. And indeed, if you break the nucleus open, the DNA will spring out like this. And so you can break the DNA, the nucleus, by putting it in salty water, detergent to break the fat layer, and salt to grind up against it. And you can grind over the nuclear thing, and the DNA will split out. So the DNA, which is in your cell, you can't see it. So the DNA, the nucleus, is too small to see with a microscope, but the DNA is in there. And so this is a really small string. I think you can go, the DNA that you hold in your body will stretch to the sun and back 5 times. I'm not sure. I have to think it's 2 meters, 3.7 trillion cells. I can't remember. Is it 37 trillion? If you add 60 trillion kilometers, I think it's just an incredible long way. I'll have to go back and put it in my head. So your DNA is not that stringy. We don't have a solar system worth of across the Earth's orbit in terms of amount of DNA. The DNA is a couple of nanometers across, a few atoms across, but it's incredibly long. And this DNA, if you break it and let it escape, it will expand out like anything and tangle and form a knotty stuff. It's not knotty because it's actually compressed in there. And what happens is it's uncoiled and repelling each other. So the DNA is actually repelling each other and holding itself away from each other, away from the DNA. So the DNA is actually suspended by its own spring repulsion. I'm going to sneeze. Okay, I found a new way to not sneeze. You say, I'm going to sneeze, and it just disappears. So getting back to it. Oh, incidentally, talking about blowing your nose, a lot of the mucus and snot, a lot of the snot inside your nose, that gooiness is DNA. So some of that is DNA in that mucus. So if you do it, you can get these long strands of DNA, and it look like snot, so to speak, and you can scoop it out. Now, your DNA is more oily, okay, so it's slightly more oily. So what you do is you put a solvent which is not completely oily, because that would be no good. You put isopropanol. Now, isopropanol is basically got one bit of water and the rest is an oil. It's a sort of a combination. It's an alcohol and an oil. And so it's isopropanol, it's rubbing alcohol, it's slightly oily and clean. You rub it on your feet for some reason. Don't know what the purpose is. So if you have a injection, they will rub you with the alcohol. They rub on you is not alcohol you can drink. It's that rubbing alcohol. Isopropanol, love it. As a compound, I'm completely in love it. You chill this down. So why you chill it down, I don't quite understand. But it means that the DNA you've separated in your mush, your strawberry, or whatever it is, you straw it up, it will spring in. It's got a spring in a sense, oily, and it will rush into the more oily liquid. And so you can watch it, and you can, if you look under a microscope as it's doing this, you'll see the DNA, which is invisible to see, will snake up and start to stick to each other because it's oily and sticks to each other. It's quite, when it's expanded. And you can see the little DNA rush up, sort of clam together and rush into the isopropanol. Isopropanol, being oily, is a bit more light than water, and being cold, look, I don't quite understand why it has to be cold, but you do have to chill it in a fridge, whatever, and it comes up, and you can separate DNA that way. Now, the important thing is, so it's in this nuclear pore. Now, obviously, if you have a nucleus and you've got a flagellum behind it, i.e. it's a sperm, so you cut down half sperm, it's got half the DNA, but then it has to be evertighted. So the sperm, its DNA is absolutely crushed by the external explosion of your DNA. And so when the sperm travels to an egg, it actually explodes. The DNA explodes into the egg. Bang! Bang! So you can imagine, I don't know, basically, if anyone's got a pillow in a cushion cover, you can actually stuff it in. And so the DNA is not really active inside a sperm because it's too crushed. Now, the other aspect of it is if the DNA is repelled into water, the RNA, which goes in, and there's machines which go along the DNA and allows the DNA to produce RNA bits, strips. These strips are water repellent. They've got the hydroxy. So if you look at the DNA and RNA, they look the same, except, there's no H missing there. There's no H missing there on the inside. And that's why it's deoxied. So the RNA is oxy. It's much more water soluble. And so it's repelled. And it's got short little sequences, and it's got little portals that something which is not so oily can get through. So the nucleus has pores which allow the RNA to pass in, we'd assume, in and out. That's, chemicals have to pass into the RNA. The nucleus can't be a shell which... The nucleus shell stops the DNA getting out. If it could get out, it would. It would just walk out. So it's got these little doors in it which allow the RNA to presumably pass out and pass in. And presumably chemicals have to get in somehow into the nucleus, because the nucleus, it has to switch on and produce different things. Pretty much in a cycle, like, say if you're feeling sleepy, your sleep-wake cycle, it's a sequence, a fairly complicated, Rupert Goldberg machine of chemistry inside of you, which determines your sleep-wake cycle. You know, the way that you exist is a phenomena. Anyway, so the important thing is that the RNA, once produced, it's produced deep inside the DNA, is repelled, and there is this force which, once it makes a strip of RNA, that RNA is will snake its way out. There's no machines inside the DNA, that's one thing. There's no proteins inside the DNA. Oh, there is some, but there's no mechanical machines operating. Oh, there are mechanical machines. I'm going to have to keep on doing it. So the DNA has to get ATP inside it. So it's something which uses up, the nucleus requires it, and this operates these machines. And the RNA, once produced, is repelled from the inside of this. Now, one of the great things people have been able to do is sequence dyes that have a bit of RNA codon. I don't quite know how it works, but these dyes can colour bits of the DNA, and you can actually put a different colour for each of your chromosomes, and you can actually look at a cell under these fluorescent microscopes. Now, how I've said before, microscopes can't see, conventional microscopes can't see a nucleus, yet we have these microscopes which can see a nucleus. And how this happens, we'll just put it aside, is that you have this concept of, well, if I use the light, the same lens to illuminate as to observe. I have a beam slipper up there. I have a confocal microscope here. You can see a tower of two. If I do something else and use multi-photon stuff, I can each number of photons increases my resolution. And if I also have something that I only detect a particular signal, I get very high resolution. So if I have something, a searchlight, which goes in and only illuminates when I put it in there, I can actually, when the light goes on, only glows up, I can actually get a very high precision picture of a nucleus. I can actually see a nucleus. And so when the nucleus is up and running, it's all spread out. It's sort of like you're coming home. You're coming home and the stuff is, rather than just in flat packs, you just throw it in and it springs out and self-assembles. It's a beautiful type of thing. So that type, when you see the DNA in those little X things, is only... If you'd like it, if you imagine someone dancing and forming a figure X when they go olé, yes, you photograph it and you can see who's who because it's together. The rest of the time, the DNA is dancing. So we watch it and we photograph it at a particular point in its dance. And so people who don't know this think, well, that's what DNA looks like. But most of the time, it's completely scrambled out. And we can actually see it's a springy type of stuff. And the DNA has got the ability to spring, but the springiness can be wound back in. So the DNA is repelling each other, but the DNA strand itself can start to fold and move out. And so what happens is that, imagine I have this, I don't know, a kilometre long hose, and I think, well, what am I going to do? I have to wind up this hose. How the heck am I going to do it? So one method would be, this is the method which isn't used, is to get a big reel and walk over and just drag it from one end in a big, big coil. You could do that, or you could be magic biological billion years of evolution thing. I can just suddenly throw in these mini reels, and each mini reel can wind up about a meter of rope each. You know, a few turns around it, and then these mini reels can pull up and stretch and bend the DNA, and the DNA coils clockwise one way, anti-clockwise the other way, clockwise one way, the other way, and it just... I can coil up a kilometre of rope like that by throwing these coilers in my box. And what happens is that these coilers, just coil us one, two, three loops of DNA around it. So it's very small, about the width of DNA. These very small coilers, I think they're called nucleosomes, something like that. And so the great thing is that I can put this magic thing, juice on DNA, and it will shrink and coil up, ready, of course, to... So previously, your suitcases, which is your nucleus is bulging, you put this in, it suddenly doesn't bulge. You can imagine it would shrink a little bit. And what happens, the DNA is no longer resisting each other, it's now neatly coiled. It's got something that really likes to wrap around. Wrap around in a basic structure, microstructure, medium structure, macrostructure, and forms a helix of a helix of a helix. So you have this double helix, which is, it's all swung out there. When you see it there, it's in its coiled state. And the fact that you see it not only in its coiled state, but also in the state of replication. Now, I myself can't quite understand, does it replicate in the uncoiled state? Because I can't see it can replicate, how it can replicate itself if it's coiled. Okay, this is something I don't understand. It hasn't been explained to me fully. But there's this process that people tend to say it coils up and then it replicates. What I do think happens is that it makes a copy of itself and it's joined together at a particular point. So you've got a kilometre and 600 metres in is a fuse point, and from that fuse point is where it's replicated from. It's that fuse point. And then I think this is my only logical way, is that when it's all complicated, it will repel each other, not get tangled because it's repelling each other, and make a I think this is a 3-3', 5-5', for lagging leading strands of the DNA, and it will produce this thing. So you suddenly, when you take a picture of your DNA, it will be suddenly at that point. And the in this case, it's stuck together at 600 point of 1,000 bases long. And what happens is that there's little ropes which attach to that DNA chromosome. There's a weird term for it. And at that point, the ropes will pull and rip it apart. It's like a Velcro, and rip the two things apart, and you'll get a copy on the two ropes. That's the mechanical machinery of this is, you would get possibly a 3-year-old or something like that to explain how you would do it. And they would say magic rope, magic little robots inside. So your DNA is replicated by nanorobots, which do the timing, like these little Lilliput munchkins, whatever they are, I forgot what they call in Charlie Chocolate Factory. I just really can't remember. These little robots, it's all going in. It's fantastic. As you could imagine, asking a 3-year-old child to explain it, and the parents go, "Who's making it up? This is complete rubbish." And then you say, "Well, indeed, this 3-year-old who's described this fantastic process is absolutely correct." And of course, I have actually gone in exactly that situation. A small kid has been pressing his mother, began chatting with me, and then small kid has said, "Oh, I think it's this." And I said, "Matter of fact, you are right. That is true. These little ropes, to get the ropes to pull at the same time, these little people come along, and the rope gets built and destructed by this way." And they got a fair amount of it right. And the parents, who thought I knew nothing, just shoo them away. Don't speak to that. Oh, that's you're not someone who knows. And of course, they would then say, "Well, we're not teaching our kid." I don't know. This is true. We're not teaching our kid. You don't know. And then so and so over there knows. Oh, and of course you say, "Oh, perhaps I've got things wrong." And it turns out that the person who was over there had no idea. The only thing they said is, "I understand." Of course, when you ask them, they said they became evasive, and they just really hadn't really thought it through. Now, I don't say that I've got it completely correct. I've got it sort of logically added together. So we've got this process here. Now, one of the things I want to say is that although we've got the DNA and we've got these fantastic sequencing techniques, it's a numbers game. So we've learnt to identify small fractions of your DNA which mutate at a very high rate and are very individual. So they have been mutating a lot. And we focus on these to get identity. We've got other areas of DNA we know to look for different genes, and I think there's something like 32,000, I really can't remember, this is just off the top of my head, unique human genes that make us up. And of course, just those proteins, I couldn't go to a protein bar and say, look, I want protein, and 32,000 later is, bring it home, honey, I'm making a baby, and I've got to add this protein, and this, it doesn't work that way. The actual protein has to be switched on at certain times. So there are certain proteins which only switch on for, say, a brief period in development. We're trying to get that out. So the issue here is that the human genome is not yet fully understood. It is not completely sequenced. Even though we've popped the champagne cork, given the people the Nobel Prize, Clinton sort of smiled, how did the Americans do it so quickly? What they did is they said, the 98 is the new 100%. And of course that 2% is a very difficult to track down because it's in the mitochondrial DNA, just trying to pick it out, and it's also in other bits. So I think there's yet other bits which are still not going there. So there's still a thing, and we haven't sequenced one mammal. This is one thing which actually gives milk. So far we haven't got a whole genome. However, there are these projects which offer genome sequencing, and this is interesting. This is interesting now. This is whole genome sequencing, around $1,000 each now. Okay, it's getting down there. I think $100 is where it was. $100, $10, $1 each. Sequences your entire genome. However, we're at the stage now that for a biology class, for the biology classes now, they say, well, everyone give your DNA. The ethics of this is just appalling, and it can only be ethic because it can be complete rubbish what we're producing. And so you go through the process, and the students do an assignment on their own genome. Now, obviously it's not the complete sequence, it may be a small sequence, but obviously they're producing sequences, and this is obviously, if it's wrong, it's, well, I don't know what goes on. Now, ethically, I think there could be some major problems down the track with that. If you do your genome, and it must be a section that can't identify you. You can't actually do a paternity test. You could say if your father and son did enrolled in a course, and they showed their genome, and they said, and one of the things we can prove is that the father is not related. I can imagine that this is not true. But so what's beginning to happen is that we're beginning to get these unexpected consequences. Insurance companies are promising to be good. Thank goodness someone out there can promise to be good. And I couldn't find the church, the police, politicians, armies, lawyers, thing, but insurance companies. Thank goodness they're ethical. What a relief. So we've got no worries that they can get the genome. And from the genomic data that people are merrily popping up, they are seeing the family tree, and it allows people outside to try and see if they can construct the family tree of their criminal, person that they want to put behind bars, a serial killer. They've got the serial killer's left a piece of helpful DNA here, helpful piece of DNA there. Okay, it's not in the database. They haven't applied for a gun. They haven't done a small felony, whatever it is, so it's not turned up. However, they came from there saying, oh, this mass murderer has an uncle, that's his uncle, that's his grand thing, that's the thing. Can we just go through records? And you can actually find, they're finding all these cold case murderers now from the hereditary databases. And so you've got these ethical things that, although you may not consent to have your DNA sequenced, and you may do your best to avoid it, they can still identify who you are from the DNA, even though you may not consent. They can actually say, well, you're the second cousin. We know that the murderer has to be the second cousin. So after sort of 30,000, you've got, say, two suspects. And of course, that information alone can also help help you get into it. Now, the sequencing is an interesting thing. There's something called shotgun sequencing. So, I've got, if you can imagine, a kilometer-long sausage. And my sausage analysis barbecue machine can only barbecue or process, if you can imagine, a meter-long sausage. Oh, that's okay. So what you have to do is that you have to go in and chop up your sausage. Now, one of the things is, it would be very good if you could have shears chop up your sausage every couple of things, all the same length. So what happens is that you get the DNA, you shove it in a room, and you throw in a hand grenade, and it breaks it up, and it all comes out, and you pick up all the guts and all the rubbish bits and pieces of this piece of DNA that's smashed up, and you say, blood oath, why did you do that? It'll take a supercomputer to actually put this DNA back together. And that's exactly what happens. The DNA is broken up, repeated, and so it's shotgunned several, it's shotgunned once or twice, so you can have little bits of DNA overlapping. So you can get, say, 50 to 100, and then you get another one which is 60 to 110, and so you put those two together, and it's, well, now you've got 50 to 110. It's a real arduous process of going ahead. But you need a supercomputer to go through and do it. So that's one process. And these processes are now blindingly fast in terms of heuristic searches. So I know people all over the world now say, listen to a terrorist event, and then they go, right, and they almost look at their watches to see how quickly various European nations or countries can actually sequence key DNA. I think in the Paris one, it was less than something on the order of 12 hours. Now, we don't know if there's other footage, how they've done it, or if they're saying with DNA footage. But the DNA sequencing is an intelligence tool hitherto unknown. And in Australia, we had this sequence of someone putting sabotage needles in strawberries. And they used this DNA, they extracted DNA from the needles, and you, it's a woman. It's this particular race, they knew already. And then within a short time, they actually, they destroyed half the strawberry crops, and you could buy a punnet of strawberries for 10 cents. You know, they were being dumped. You know, no one would buy the strawberries, it killed the market. But they found this person through the DNA evidence. So obviously if the police want it. And so there's the shotgun method, and the shotgun method on little nanospheres can grow these little components in nanospheres, and the nanospheres can grow a hair of this, so it can be millions, this segment can be amplified millions of times. And it's really interesting to see the enzymes that they can borrow from nature to reproduce. They can reproduce the DNA millions of times. This hair, these balls roll into basically a camera display, megapixel display. They roll in, and a sequence of chemicals are washed through it, and so it sequences millions of segments simultaneously and measures the current. Pretty much like a JPEG image. It's like the same image transfer. There's also images which attach fluorescent light, fluorescent dyes to it. But what's more interesting is that you can... So you need... The shorter your DNA fragment is, the more you can get it. So if you blow it up to a million pieces, you can go a million times faster And there's a point that where you break it up so small, the supercomputing goes incredibly high. You break it up into longer pieces, you can't hit it as much, and you don't have that process. But you can now take the entire length of DNA and put it through a little pore. And what happens as the base goes through, the resistance changes for each base until you can actually just stream the bases through. And so what's happening now is that people are just probing in terms of speed, supercomputing processes going through. And you have these really scary things going on. So different countries are collecting databases of the genome sort of thing for different groups. Now, the leading country doing this is China. So China is extracting huge quantities of DNA, supposedly to make design drugs. So at the moment, having European DNA is meaning that design drugs are first coming out for the Europeans, supposedly. It's hard to see that there's that much variation. So China's probably a little bit more sinister. There's other countries, India. Qatar has got a full, I think, 30% of its population is going to have it genetically tested. And, you know what, I think there's a big problem in terms of that it's tough enough now that if you buy some food, you can get it discounted if you give your hand your data over. And people can work out if you're depressed, happy, and this information can go in and say if you're a woman of a particular age and you buy a certain box of chocolates this week, and then baby oil next week and a baby magazine next week in your mail, the computer's algorithms have said they'll send you, are you expecting, here's a pram magazine. It gives this sort of edge. It's a bit creepy, so to speak. So the use of this DNA information so early is really concerning. But there's pretty well no way you can stop people doing it, because there's various reasons people voluntarily give up their DNA to be analysed to see if they've got a disease or not. You got that, and you've got picking up crime, and then people volunteering. I think it's all gone. Now, the final thing which I'm going to say as we conclude, and believe I could speak for an hour on this, is that we are now directly, there's he who's using some DNA trickery to deliberately edit the germline. So what happens is that I can do genetic therapy on my hand, but basically the only risk of me, I don't use my hand. It's an important part of getting the next generation going, but my hand is actually not, the genes in my hand are not actually used to transfer. So if they genetically engineer my gonads, or they genetically engineer an embryo, all of the embryo genetically engineer. So I can grab a piece of tissue and I can genetically engineer that and change it. And that tissue will continue in my body forever from that point. But if I genetically engineer an embryo, I can then treat all the cells in that embryo and therefore it can go forever. And of course, or I could genetically engineer my ovaries or my sperm production. Yeah, that's a little bit harder for me to imagine. And that would then affect germline stuff. So I could make myself funny. I could make myself a better podcaster. There's heaps of things I'd be just queuing up to do. Ethically, that's a nightmare. And the understanding I have from speaking to scientists is that there's this person called He, which is rather unfortunate, because when you construct your surname, it's also an English pronoun. So when you say, and he thought such and such, You go, and then he has disappeared. So what's happened is this Chinese rogue scientist has begun genetically engineering these people, and what he's done is, in doing it, not only has he not subjected himself to scrutiny, he's outraged people. So he said he's got this uneducated Chinese to sign up for this program, saying that misrepresented the risks of their children contracting HIV, and saying this genetic thing I do will protect your kid from HIV. So he wasn't able to guarantee it. Then he said that you're free to leave the trial anytime you want. However, although it's free to enter the trial, to leave it, you have to pay back all the money of talking to him. And so there's this big, they're saying, hang on, this person is not doing any step ethically, yet he's saying it's ethical as last step. So all, it's like this due process, process reading your rights. There's certain things that have to be done for it to even qualify to get onto the table to get ethical analysis. So it's lost itself. It's sort of like an application which is wildly inaccurate. And of course, this was even the Chinese government said this is a step too far. And it's wildly believed that he has disappeared. People can't hear from him anymore. The Chinese have made this particular genetic scientist get away, which is just an absolute amazing thing. So, look, I hope you've enjoyed this story of DNA in a nucleus, and it's about you, so that's great. It's, for me, the understanding of the oiliness and the forces of DNA making it a sort of a springy, repulsive molecule, and the fact that you've got this watery stuff and oil and water repel each other, so the RNA shoots out the nuclear wall, but the nuclear wall has to have these certain properties, are very very intensely interesting to work your way through. And I really haven't gone through it in detail, but again, it takes a bit of saying, well, hang on, what does a cell need to get going? Oh, it needs to make protein. How does it make protein? It makes it from RNA machinery. The RNA machinery comes out with the information, the transport, and the actual machinery come together, and all go together and click and make your proteins. So and proteins are little machines. They're chemical machines, or they're mechanical machines. If they're mechanical machines, or even they're chemical machines, they get charged up by super cell food, battery food, which are just these little recyclable A-cell batteries, which triple A cells, adenine triphosphate, tri-3, and it goes from 2 to 3 coming through as it goes through. The phosphides peel off and the charge goes back, and they're little batteries, and the charge force goes through, and the charge suddenly acting on the protein creates a charge, and the proteins can't move. Proteins are chemicals, and chemicals only move due to electric fields. Sorry about that. And so this is how it goes. So and you have the mitochondria. Where does the word mitochondria come from? It's a little bacteria which you have enslaved inside your cell, and its only object is to, you basically are farming them. You're milking them. So typically we get a cow, we say, the grass looks like that. Yep, problem with the grass, it's a bit grassy. In fact, it's green, I can't really get myself to swallow it, there's blah, blah. And you say, however, I've got my cow here, eat the cow and I milk it. So what happens is sugar and oxygen are a bit toxic to the you, But you put the two together, and your mitochondria is a bit like a cow. It munches it, and it milks, it produces the milk of this ATP, which goes around and feeds electricity to your proteins. So I hope that's some way of explaining it. I've got my other podcast is going to go, and this is going to be a 5-minute podcast. It's an hour and 10 minutes. I hope it's a worthwhile podcast, and it helps you understand it. It helps me explain it bit by bit going through. Thanks for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.